There was a fat old Deutscher man, his name was Dunderbeck. He was very fond of sausages and sauerkraut and speck. He kept a great big butcher shop, the finest ever seen, and he got him out a patent for a sausage meat machine. Oh, Dunderbeck, how could you be so mean? I'm sorry you ever invented that wonderful machine. For dogs and cats and long-tailed rats will never more be seen. Oh, they'll all be ground to sausage meat in Dunderbeck's machine.
Hello, K-Squid listeners. It's every other Sunday again. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and you're listening to Sustainability Now, a biweekly K-Squid radio program focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. There's an old saying attributed to the 19th century German Chancellor Otto von Bismarck, although some people say he didn't say it. Laws, like sausages, cease to inspire respect in proportion as we know how they are made. Today we're going to talk about law and sausages. So if you ever took a civics or government class in high school or college, you probably learned how a bill becomes law through a clean and straightforward process. You might have learned about lobbyists and interests too, but probably never had to trace legislation from its origins to its implementation. The actual process is a good deal more sleazy and arcane than we are taught, and in many ways it's more like a game of Calvin ball in which the rules are made up as you go along. My guest today is Ali Detrio, founder and chief strategist of Reimagine Power in San Francisco, which she founded. At Reimagine Power, Ali focuses on policy and market strategy for microgrids, distributed energy resources, clean tech, and sustainability in the West Coast. She works with clean energy developers, clean tech startups, nonprofits, serves as the representative for the microgrid industry, intervenes in regulatory proceedings, lobbies for bills, writes papers, reads documents, organizes grassroots support for policy, and serves as a liaison for many trade associations. So she is thick in the middle of California solar law and sausages. Ali, welcome to Sustainability Now. Can you hear me? Oh, are you there, Ali?
Can you hear me?
Yes, now I can hear you. I didn't have the level turned up, so.
Great. No, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So why don't we just start with all of this with a little bit of basic background. So your official position at Reimagine Power is chief strategist. So what is a chief strategist as opposed to a CEO?
Good question. So I am technically the founder and CEO of Reimagine Power, but I don't really like introducing myself as that because founders and CEOs of startups are a dime a dozen in San Francisco. And when I first started Reimagine Power, I wanted it to almost seem like it wasn't just me. So I call myself the chief strategist because I'm the mastermind behind all of this work. And so that seems like a more appropriate title versus someone that manages, the business affairs. And while I do kind of do that, it's not my primary role. My primary role is to strategize about the energy industry and about how to make policies and regulations beneficial for the people and the ecosystems that we're serving.
So do you think of yourself as a lobbyist or consultant or something else?
I'm kind of a blend of all many different things. I would say, first and foremost, I am a consultant, and I advise a number of different clients on different clean energy issues related to microgrids and sustainable energy. I do some lobbying and advocacy work. That's not, I would say, my primary role, so I'm not a registered lobbyist, but I do some advocacy work and helping to educate policymakers and regulators on the benefits of clean energy and about distributed energy resources in particular. But I'd also say I'm a collaborator and bringing together, many different groups and I try to influence the influencers in a way. And so that's why I work with a lot of trade associations. I really work to help them make the best informed business decisions they can for the industries that they serve. And then that helps them advocate in Sacramento and, around the country, like in D.C. as well. And so I really focus on more of a ground level approach as opposed to straight lobbying at Sacramento, although I do some of that in normal times.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you and Reimagine Power actually do? Well, you've told us all about that, right? But, I mean, you know, what's this?
Better than I could.
Huh?
You summed up better than I could in the introduction.
Oh, okay. Well, that was actually something I cribbed that you had written. Well, how did you get into this business? You know, what in your background prepared you for this work?
Great question. So I went to school. So I'm born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio, which is very commonly known as a Rust Belt city, very coal and oil centric. And I never thought a thing about, you know, all of the coal plants and, you know, underserved industrial areas of my hometown and home state. And then I went away to college. I went to Arizona State University, and I actually started my degree in civil and environmental engineering, but I'll admit I was a weed-out student in the engineering program there, and I made it 2.5 years before calculus and physics decided that I wasn't fit to be an engineer. And so, coincidentally, at that time, Arizona State University was just launching their first of its kind in the world, Global Institute of Sustainability. And one of my classmates in engineering, who was also suffering the same fate as me, said, hey, you should look at this. You can still do some engineering courses, but it doesn't have to be this nitty-gritty, hardcore engineering. It's more of understanding how engineering and energy like impacts the rest of the environment. And so I said, that sounds really interesting, and I definitely need to keep my scholarship, so I got to get my grades up, and that's why I'm switching majors. So I switched into the sustainability program, and what was interesting at that time is I went into kind of a 180 where I decided that I was going to learn about sustainability and take a break from the technical side and learn more about some other subjects I was interested in but hadn't had a chance to really explore. So I ended up with minors in history and philosophy and economics and my major in sustainability with the concentration in economics. And I think that actually served me very well when I think about it coming full circle, because a lot of the education in history and philosophy that I did, learning to think critically about subjects, applying logic, writing very, you know, reading dense material and synthesizing it into, you know, coherent summaries, all of that work, I think, really prepared me to find policy, which I did when I actually was at my final year at ASU and graduating college. I worked at the Salt River Project, which is the third largest municipal utility in the country. They do water and power and serve the Phoenix metro area. And I became really fascinated with water because it's so essential to, you know, humanity and society. So I was really enjoying that. So I was a research analyst in the water policy department. And then after a while, you know, I was an intern, I was a contractor, my position was up, and they said, you should look at applying at the power sector. We don't have any positions here in water at this moment, but you should look at energy. And that was really the first time that I thought, huh, you know, what do people need more than anything else in this world? Water and power in the 21st century. Power is important to every aspect of our daily lives. So I turned to that. And while I didn't end up going into SRP's power division, that led me to find solar energy and really start getting into solar energy efficiency. And then that led me to more renewables in my previous role when I worked at ENGIE, which is a global energy services provider. And that's where I found everything from solar, microgrids, battery storage. So I've worked on a number of different issue areas, even hydrogen. And that led me to eventually starting Reimagine Power, where I really become very invested in policy and regulation and seeing how that's so essential to the energy industry and how it's governed. And so I really wanted to, like, help make that system better. And so that's what's led me to this work over the years.
Well, before you moved to California, how much did you know about the legislative process and how it worked here?
I didn't know hardly anything about the legislative process, I will admit. When I first came to ENGIE, I got basically thrown into it and discovered, you know, that being the boots on the ground with government regulatory affairs, and that just spurred a whole new, like, passion for my career that I, you know, I was always very passionate about energy and sustainability, but I really found, I think, my calling with policy. So you really can't get a true education in it until you just get in there and do it. And so I had the privilege of working on several bills over the years, some which failed, some which passed, and I think you just, you get in there and you start working it, and there's no substitute for the real world experience. And what's great is that the energy industry, I think, largely is very collaborative and, you know, open to helping people. And so that's really, I've learned from a lot of different mentors and coaches. I owe a lot of thanks to my former boss, Walker Wright, who's now a vice president at Sunrun, for teaching me so much about the legislative process and the intrinsic, you know, the sausage making, if you will. And I'm really thankful that I've gotten to get so deeply involved in it over the years. But I would say it's something that's very hard to teach. It's something you just have to go in and roll up your sleeves and start working in it to get the experience firsthand.
Well, I'm still learning about it. And I have to say, you know, although I taught politics for 30 years, I never did anything about with California or the California legislature. And it's remarkably opaque and arcane. I will say that. I want to talk in a bit after we're going to take a break in a few minutes, and I want to talk a bit about the California's electricity system and regulation. But before that, where do bills come from? I mean, where do the ideas for legislation come from?
That's a great question. So I taught in school, and you know, in Schoolhouse Rock, that you know, people bring bill ideas to lawmakers, and the lawmakers agree to champion them and, you know, put them through that process that they make it seem very straightforward as in the intro. Really, I would say most laws are written by special interest groups. And what happens is a lot of different corporations, special interest groups, nonprofits, different advocacy organizations will propose different ideas to different legislators that they have built relationships with, may have funded their campaigns and other like reelection and, you know, at political activities. And they really write a lot of the legislation. Both the staffers and legislative council, which is part of the overall system of the California state government, they absolutely have a role in helping to craft like the language and help shepherd it through the process. But I'd say most of the bills these days really come from those kinds of groups and stem from that. And then over the period of making a bill become a law, there's lots of negotiations that happen, a lot of different stakeholders weighing in with their positions on the bill. And so bills go through an evolution as they go through the legislative process. So it ends up being, there's no one author of any one bill.
Yeah, someone once explained to me that well, many things are sort of start out, you know, as very diffuse, and as people debate and negotiate them, they get more and more focused. And at the very point where they get written down, where, for instance, a bill is first presented, right, they're very concise. And then comes the interpretive part. And by the time you're through with the interpretation, again, there are dozens and dozens of different ways to explain that. And, you know, it's the same thing with the Constitution. What did the founders mean? Or is it what we want to do now? But it's a bit alarming to hear that, although everyone knows it, that special interests, whether they be corporations or, you know, activists, are the ones who write the bills. Do legislators ever write their own bills?
Having not worked for it, I've not been a legislative staffer myself, so
yeah.
I can't confirm or deny that, but I... Most of the time, it's not written by the bill author. The bill author is usually in name mostly, I would say.
So they're sort of like the host for a virus. We need to take a break. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org, streaming on the internet. You're listening to Sustainability Now. This is Ronnie Lipschitz. My guest today is Ali Detrio, founder and chief strategist of Reimagine Power in San Francisco. And Ali focuses on various aspects of renewable clean energy policy, bills, papers, and many, many other things. And we were just talking about how laws get made, you know, how laws like sausages get made, but you don't really want to know what the process is. Well, we're going to talk about a couple of laws, but before we do that, maybe you can say something about how the electricity system in California is set up and regulated, and maybe about its history and the actors involved in its regulation and operation.
Sure. I'm happy to give a high-level overview. So our state's electricity system is governed through the California Public Utilities Commission, which is given broad regulatory authority set out by the California Constitution. And back when the Rural Electrification Initiative was first passed in the United States back in the 1930s, we really had a mission in the 20th century of bringing power to all people, as it was seen as a necessity for, you know, public health and well-being, and also as a driver of economic growth. And so there was a problem, though, in terms of gathering the necessary capital and making the appropriate infrastructure investments so that we could bring electricity to all people. And this is where the concept of the regulated monopoly electric utility came into play, where these businesses would agree to be regulated, but they would be private, so they would put up capital, make investments on behalf of their ratepayers, who would all pay into the system over time. In exchange for being regulated, these companies are given a natural monopoly through a franchise agreement, so that they have exclusive rights to distribute electricity in their service territory and get a guaranteed rate of return on those investments.
Maybe we should mention that the notion of the regulated monopoly was instituted to prevent competing companies from bankrupting each other, as happened in the Pennsylvania oil field. Sorry, I just had to add that. Go on.
Yeah, no, that's a good point to add. Thank you for that. And yeah, so that was the original, and it was also designed, you know, with the government regulator giving enough oversight so that rates would be low, and so that is the charter of the Public Utilities Commission, is to, you know, make sure that there is safe, reliable, and affordable electricity, and that still is the CPUC's main mission today. So over the years and over the decades, as technology has continued to evolve and advance, we are now seeing a plethora of different technologies that are available to customers that really weren't available in the 20th century when our electricity system was first being built. And what we're dealing with today is basically a energy system that is wanting to evolve with the technology and provide, you know, customers wanting to be more engaged with their energy usage by buying solar panels or smart thermostats or batteries in their garage, or, you know, schools making these investments, or any type of business really wanting to have greater control over their energy costs. And our regulatory system was not built and constructed with customers being, you know, active consumers. They were envisioned as passive consumers in a one-way flow of electricity from large central generating stations and power plants transmitted through long-distance transmission systems down to the individual customer who would just pay their bill and expect the service, and that was it. Now that we have these two-way power flows, I think it's really introduced a new level of complexity for our regulatory systems, and we are trying to evolve the regulatory system to keep up with the technology, which is a very difficult task for regulators, for the technology providers, and for the utilities who are struggling to figure out what is their role going to be in this evolving paradigm where they're not the only game in town. And so obviously there's a lot of friction that comes with that. And given they have a 100-year history of, you know, basically being the only game in town for providing their essential service, they are not going to easily give that up. I will give a plug to Dennis Kucinich, has a book out, The Division of Light and Power. He is my hometown city of Cleveland former mayor, and he was one of the main leaders at the time that saved Cleveland Public Power and kept Muni Light public for the city of Cleveland. And his book does a really good job of articulating a lot of the different strategies employed by electric utilities in the fossil fuel industry to manipulate governments and regulation to their favor. So over, you know, the course of the decade with them agreeing to be regulated, they have become very well-oiled regulatory machines, and so they do wield a lot of power and influence over the regulatory process that was arguably designed to keep them in check. Nowadays, we sometimes think that the utilities are really the ones writing the regulations, really having a strong influence over them. And so there is a lot of tension in the current system today with how do we grapple with so many new players and technologies, and how do we do that in a way that still best serves the public?
Okay. Well, why don't we talk about solar legislation now? And there are two bills that I thought we might be able to talk about. The first is SB 1339 from 2018, and that directed the California PUC to develop plans to commercialize microgrids. The second one was just recently tabled in the state assembly. It's AB 1139, which essentially was trying to reform or revise or change net energy metering plans based on the argument that low-income customers are subsidizing high-income homeowners with rooftop solar systems. So let's start with 1339. What was it meant to do, and what happened with it?
Sure, that's a great question. I will say I had the privilege of being on the ground in Sacramento on SB 1339 back in 2018. It's an achievement I'm very proud of, is helping to pass that bill. And I'll say this, back in 2018, even 2017, when the idea was first really germinated, me and a small group of stakeholders that were focused on microgrids and looking beyond just your passive, you know, unfettered solar production, and looking towards how do we get more controlled DERs on the grid, meaning ones that are able to optimize and respond to grid conditions instead of just exporting power back through a traditional net metering process that we have today. And so the CEC, the California Energy Commission, they had done a couple grant programs with microgrids that really showed the promise of these technologies. And so Senator Stern in 2018 agreed to run a bill that was going to direct the California Public Utilities Commission to commercialize microgrids through the development of separate rates and tariffs for microgrids, so that we could start having these be adopted by a wider set of customers. And so at the time, we had the Napa Wine Country fires and several others in the state, but we hadn't yet had the Camp Fire of 2018 happen. That was in November. And so really, there was no focus, there was not a big focus on resiliency with 1339. Mm-hmm. It was about commercializing technology and really about how do we modernize solar energy and other distributed energy resources to be more responsive to grid needs. So it really had, resiliency is obviously important, but it really wasn't a main talking point for us as we were lobbying for the bill, which is interesting. So what happened with the bill is it eventually did pass. It was a hard-fought, process, but we did get the bill passed and signed into law, which I'm really excited about. The Public Utilities Commission then had a number of other things happen between the time that the bill was passed and the time they actually opened a proceeding to implement the bill. First was the Camp Fire, and that was obviously very devastating. We are all still reeling years later from the effects of that wildfire and so many others, but that wildfire in particular was found to be caused by PG&E negligence in upgrading their infrastructure, and that sent them into bankruptcy at the very beginning of 2019, which also coincided with Gavin Newsom becoming elected governor and coming into office. And so the California Public Utilities Commission had a lot on its plate in trying to deal with the wildfires, deal with the bankruptcy, and we were advocating for a while for them to open the proceeding right away as a response for wildfires and the immense challenges that we had in front of us. And instead, the CPUC did not open the proceeding until end of 2019, I believe it was September or October, and that's when they actually opened the proceeding to implement the bill. Then, by that point, we had started, talking about what the scope of the proceeding would look like, what issues we were going to tackle, and then in October is when PG&E instituted the first really widespread PSPS events that caused multi-day outages for great swaths of Northern California, and I know Santa Cruz experienced many of those too. And that really brought the commission into, I think, sharp focus in the media and with the governor's administration, and what are we going to do about these blackouts? And we also have hanging over us the specter of Gray Davis, who was famously recalled after the rolling blackouts and the energy crisis back in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
So the CPUC, using its constitutional authority given to it by the state, expanded the scope of the proceeding to not only implement SB 1339, which is to facilitate the commercialization of microgrids by forming separate rates and tariffs, they also expanded it to include resiliency strategies. And that was not part of the legislation at all. Nowhere in the final text of that bill is the word resiliency. But the CPUC felt they needed to expand the scope of the proceeding to deal with more than just microgrids. And by doing that, I would argue that they've really hindered a lot of the progress that we have been trying to make on deploying resilient energy systems. Because had they just focused on creating the separate rates and tariffs for microgrids that would have incentivized and spurred development of microgrids all over the state to help us with these blackouts, they have instead spent a lot of time focused on the utilities and the things the utilities are doing, not really looking to empower customers. And to this day, we do not actually have a functional microgrid tariff. And it's 2021. We've been at this proceeding for more than 2 years. The CPUC is currently looking to wrap up track three of the proceeding and continue on with a track four. So we're still working at the Public Utilities Commission 2 years since the opening of the proceeding to actually get a functional microgrid tariff in place.
Well, I know that these proceedings, I mean, they're hearings, right, in which interveners submit various documents. And the utilities and it's the staff of the Utilities Commission comes up with proposals. Interveners react to that, and then the commission looks at these proposals and decides whether they're going to become policy or not. Right? That's how it works, basically.
In a sense, yes. So what usually happens is that the staff of the CPUC will submit a staff proposal to kind of kick off the proceeding. And that's what they did in track one of the proceeding, as well as track two. And then, yes, stakeholders have an opportunity to comment, to speak with the commission and staffers, and to help, influence what these regulations should look like. Then what happens is they come out with a proposed decision, meaning a proposed regulation that parties can provide comments on, including specific red lines or proposed changes that would make the regulation better. And so then after a period of time, the commission deliberates, and then they issue a final decision. Usually comes out about 72 hours before a PUC voting meeting, and then they will vote on the final decision in the voting meeting. That's essentially how it works.
And then what happens? Well, maybe let's take a break, because I want you to tell us, once the decision has been made, right, what happens with that decision? So let me take a short break. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM on your radio dial and KSQD.org, streaming on the internet. Well, you're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Ali Detrio, chief strategist and founder of Reimagine Power in San Francisco. And we've now been talking about what you might think of as the second legislative process, which is what happens in state commissions, administrative commissions, when a law has to be interpreted and then implemented. And I was just going to ask, once this PUC, the Public Utilities Commission, has voted on a, on a policy, on a staff proposal, then how does it get actually implemented?
Excellent question. Usually there's a process of directing the utilities or any other entities within the commission that may need to do something, but it's usually the utilities direct them in the form of advice letters to start carrying out the orders of the decision. So in the instance of creating a microgrid tariff, for example, they would be looking to direct the utilities to submit advice letters that roll out exactly the details of the tariff language that's going to be proposed, the timeline for actually making this tariff available to customers, other programmatic details like that. And then the utilities will file advice letters, which are just notices, essentially, of here is what we're proposing to do. This is also kind of what I would call the last call of if you have protests or concerns or just comments to reiterate to the commission that you'd like to hear on the advice letter, on the advice letter in particular, you can submit those comments. The commission and the utilities will obviously take that into consideration. Sometimes the commission will suspend an advice letter pending further review, where they will do some sort of supplemental staff review and maybe issue additional guidance to the utilities. But largely, they will then approve the advice letter, and the utility will carry out those actions within the dedicated time frames that they've proposed within the advice letter. And so that's kind of the tail end of the regulatory process. And then eventually a program or a tariff or something will be made available to customers, and there's usually details of any potential like marketing education outreach or any other things that might need to be done to their internal billing systems or other operations that need to be prepared in advance of them opening these types of things to customers. And then once it's open, you know, then you have customers that are able to subscribe to different, you know, programs that are laid out and actually take advantage of these benefits. So that's essentially the regulatory process in a nutshell. I will say that it's very arduous. You said arcane. I would say it's also very, tends to be very legal and dominated by the legal industry. So many lawyers and attorneys or, you know, people's consultants will be involved in this process. And so it's very formal. Everything must be submitted in exactly the right format. And so a lot of people find the Public Utilities Commission process very unapproachable, and it's very hard for an individual to participate in the process. Now, to the Public Utilities Commission's credit, they did just adopt a rule recently, which I think everyone should know about, which is the public can now submit informal comments to the Public Utilities Commission on any rulemaking or proceeding, and it will be entered into the record of that proceeding so that the commissioners, as they're making these decisions, have more input from the public on these matters, because they have realized over the course of several years and lots of different nonprofits and community groups advocating for a easier process for them to participate in have taken a recent step to add that rule to allow for more public input on these issues. So I think that's a really important thing, because otherwise this process really does tend to be dominated by lawyers, utilities, and, you know, consultants who spend a lot of time reading these filings like myself. So it is very difficult for the regular average Joe to participate. And that's one of the reasons I think why the utilities have been so successful over the decades in really manipulating these regulations to their favor, because they really just dominate the whole regulatory arena.
To wrap up this particular discussion, what happened? What ultimately has happened with that bill and that, you know, directive to commercialize microgrids? I mean, what are the utilities actually doing as a result?
That's a great question. They are in the process of doing several things. One is that the Public Utilities Commission authorized them to utilize temporary diesel generation at substations to mitigate the risk of outages for customers. So that was one of the big decisions of track one that was arguably very controversial, and I would say was quite disappointing considering all the other avenues that the commission could have taken. So that was one thing. So now we have lots of mobile temporary diesel generation being stationed at different substations around the state in preparation for outages. Then the PUC opened up a track two of this proceeding to start looking at some of the other issues, truly trying to commercialize microgrids. And they issued a decision with five main topics looking to help ease the regulations for microgrid developers, though I will say that none of the proposed changes have really borne any fruit to date, and I would say they were largely very administrative and not very impactful in their reach compared to what they could have done. The one thing that is good that's coming out of this, and I'll be interested to see how it plays out, is that the commission, expanding its authority with resiliency strategies, authorized the creation of a microgrid incentive program for in-front-of-the-meter multiple customer microgrids that are serving vulnerable populations. And the goal of this program is to fully fund microgrids in these vulnerable communities that a population would otherwise be unable to afford. So they're looking at funding probably about 15 microgrids across the state with ratepayer dollars, and they're going through a process right now of figuring out what the program criteria should be, how should scoring and the application process be prioritized, and how, you know, how customers can actually get that money. I will say I think it's quite disappointing that the Public Utilities Commission chose to go in that direction versus making a widely available microgrid tariff available to customers immediately so that we could have microgrids be distributed all around the state and have some of that cost be borne by the private sector, who would share in the cost of building microgrids and actually help reduce the cost of the infrastructure for all ratepayers by sharing in that cost.
Mm-hmm.
The incentive program targeted a few specific customers. Is general, in my opinion, is an inefficient way to distribute limited ratepayer funds. So I will be interested to see what comes out of this process. But I will say we're probably several years away from any of those microgrids being built because multi-customer microgrids are not very prevalent in California due to all the regulations we discussed earlier in the show about, you know, the competitive monopoly on distribution. So there, we're still several years away from having microgrids under this program actually be built.
Do you think that the PUC, in this whole process, the PUC was motivated in any way by trying to keep PG&E out of economic trouble?
I'm sure that was part of it.
Oh, well, okay. We can come back to that in a little while. All right. So let's talk about the other bill, AB 1339, which was just recently tabled in the state assembly, but created quite an uproar in the solar community. Can you tell us, you know, what was that bill about and what was it trying to do?
Sure. AB 1139 was authored by Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez, who's down in the San Diego region. And what's important to note about her as a legislator is that she is the chair of the Assembly Appropriations Committee. The Appropriations Committee is where all bills that have any sort of fiscal responsibility or any fiscal note have to go to determine whether or not the state should approve those bills, because it will require the state spending money on them. So arguably, the Appropriations Chair is one of the most powerful seats in Sacramento, in my opinion. So with that said, there's been a lot of complaints over the past several years about the net energy metering program and the fact that solar has largely gone to more affluent customers. And so there's been several initiatives at the Public Utilities Commission to reform the net metering program. The last one that concluded in 2016-2017 made some changes to the program to make it more cost-based and make sure that all ratepayers are benefiting from the program. But they committed to revisiting net metering again and vowed to open up a NEM 3.0 proceeding in 2019. And then, as I mentioned, with the wildfires, bankruptcy, power outages, you know, the proceeding just got delayed for an extra year. And so in 2020 is when the PUC opened up the net metering proceeding to consider further refinements to that program to make sure that it's equitable and that more consumers are having access to solar, making sure we're benefiting those populations that have traditionally been underserved. So
Let me just intervene for 1 second here. Net energy metering is a program that compensates people with solar systems on their roofs, and I guess other solar generators for the electricity that they put into the grid, to the electrical grid. And so if you generate electricity on your roof and you don't use it, it goes into the electrical grid and you get some kind of compensation for that. Okay, go on.
Yeah, no, thanks for putting that in layman's terms. So, yes, so, and net metering has been a tremendous success in California. We have the highest adoption of solar energy besides the state of Hawaii, which when you look at our population compared to Hawaii's population is quite significant. And it's really helped drive down the cost of solar. It's helped make a thriving clean energy industry. And it's really had a lot of impacts across the rest of the country, too. So it's largely actually been very successful in doing what it set out to do, which was make solar more affordable to more people and reap the environmental benefits, as well as everyone having a little bit more energy independence and being able to produce and, you know, produce and generate their own power. But there has been a lot of concerns, mostly, I would say, manufactured by several groups, including the utilities, chief among them, claiming that solar is a cost shift to people that don't have solar. And what I mean by cost shift is that because you install solar and you're able to send some of your energy back to the grid, you end up paying less on your electricity bill. And therefore, what, based on the cost of service regulation model that the utilities have, they claim that they have all these fixed costs, and that means that they have to distribute those costs onto other ratepayers by raising the rates. And so my counter to that is we should be changing the system by which you recover costs as a whole. You shouldn't be blaming solar customers for this phenomenon. However, that aside, many people have started to pick up on this notion of cost shifting, and really the utilities, I would say, being the masterminds behind this, attempting to use race and equity as a weapon against the rooftop solar industry. And what they did with 1139 was mobilize their electrical workers union, the California State of Electrical Workers, and the Coalition of California Utility Employees to mobilize and write this legislation, AB 1139, and have one of the most powerful legislators, Lorena Gonzalez, carry the bill. Now, Lorena is also known as, you know, someone that's done a lot of good things for the environmental justice community. So I think she has some sway in those groups. And so a lot of the messaging about pitting, like, it really that they were, what they're trying to do with the bill is pit the rich against the poor and white against black. And really what they were doing that for is because rooftop solar reduces the need for expensive transmission infrastructure, and that is the number one thing that the utilities earn a very handsome over 10% return on equity for their transmission investment. As more people install solar, the less we need long-distance transmission, therefore less of that infrastructure is needed, and they cannot make as much profit on it, so they can't build. There's not a justification for building it. So instead, what they're trying to do is stymie the rooftop solar industry, and I would argue energy storage and microgrids every step of the way, because it's an intrinsic threat to their business model and their profit. So 1139 was designed to, initially, the talk was, we're really looking to promote equity and really make sure that rural populations are prioritized. The initial version of AB 1139 had some good things in it. It had, I think it was $500 million going to public buildings to install solar, $250 million for multifamily affordable housing solar, and a reform to the net metering program that would have really eviscerated the market. They were proposing to repeal the retail rate credit with a wholesale rate credit, which equates to about 3 cents a kilowatt hour, which right now residential customers, you know, are spending 18 to 20 something cents on their electricity. And when they send their power back, when they have solar, they get a one-to-one compensation for that, up to their annual usage. So this would have really killed the economics of all current solar projects and future ones. Mm-hmm. And so as it went through, the first committee it went to was the Assembly Utilities and Energy Committee, where it passed out with flying colors because, again, as the chair of appropriations, Lorena holds a lot of sway over her the different committees, and none of the other legislators wanted to cross her when they have their own bills that they're trying to pass through the legislative process and wanting to get out of appropriations. Them voting no on AB 1139 would have made them a target for their own bills getting killed. And so this is where the politics comes into play, which is really a black box to most of us in the outside world, and how all of these deals get done and what, you know, what sacrifices are made for what reasons when it comes to passing policies. So yeah. The bill, after it got out of Utilities and Energy Committee, we saw a lot of environmental groups really step up to mobilize and oppose AB 1139, and seeing it for really what it was, which was really an attack on the industry as a whole. After the Utilities and Energy Committee hearing, the language that had money for public buildings and affordable housing and all the things related to equity that everyone thought were good about the bill were taken out, and we were left with a pretty draconian repeal of the net metering program if the CPUC didn't act, with a really aggressive timeline that basically would have preempted the Public Utilities Commission process of revisiting net metering, where there is a more opportunity for, you know, a due process and a fair, you know, review of the program in its details. This is really looking to preempt that. So obviously then it goes to appropriations because it has a fiscal tag. Nearly every bill does go to appropriations. And since Lorena's the chair, you know, no one even blinked an eye when that passed out of her committee. But what was great was as we were, many of us were working behind the scenes and on the ground to mobilize a lot of our, you know, best environmental champions, the Sierra Club, 350, Indivisible California Green Team, the Alliance for Community Energy. Many different groups really stepped up and mobilized their members and said, no, this is not good public policy. We do not support your efforts to subvert the PUC process and, it, you know, eliminate or really eliminate an option that's just now starting to become affordable to so many customers. And you would be killing it right at a time when we are making tremendous progress in reaching a lot more vulnerable and disadvantaged communities, as well as people that are renters, so they have an option. And so when it got to the assembly floor, it was very surprising, even to some of us who are in the inside, you know, lobbying the actual legislators themselves, where we thought they were going to get out of it, the bill was going to get out of the assembly on a narrow vote, but that it would. And the activists and the people, you know, like you and like the listeners that actually care, they all mobilized and called their legislator. They emailed. They sent letters. They all made their voices known with such a ferocity that it made their legislators really stop and think about this policy and what it means for the state of California. And then when the bill finally did go up for a vote on Wednesday, right before the legislative to pass bills out of the first house was June 4th, and on June 3rd, Scott Wetch, the lobbyist for the IBEW, asked to bring the bill up earlier than I think a lot of people were anticipating in the Capitol, but he seemed very motivated to bring the bill up. And when it was brought up, it failed on the floor. It only got 28 votes, and you need 41 to get out of the assembly. And so actually, it was really surprising because a lot of legislators that we thought were on the fence or that were probably going to give Lorena a courtesy vote because of their political relationships with her ended up abstaining from the bill, from voting at all. And then we had a lot of Republicans. The Republicans all voted no. And then we had some of our legislative champions that I think really from the start knew that this wasn't a good bill, did go and vote against it. But so then it failed on the floor. But happened, Lorena Gonzalez's co-author, Assembly Member Wendy Carrillo, who represents L.A. Boyle Heights area, she asked for the bill to be brought up for reconsideration. So they, the authors, then went and tried to basically whip votes to see if they could get 41 votes up in the assembly. The next day, it wasn't even brought up again because they did not garner enough votes to pass the bill. And I would argue that there were a lot of lobbyists on the solar industry, like working to educate lawmakers on the consequences of this bill. A lot of environmental groups, you know, really expressing how how much this would hurt, like, our progress in meeting our climate goals. But I would say the number one reason that we were successful in defeating this bill is because the people mobilized and made their voices heard so loudly that legislators could not ignore it. And so we had a lot of legislators, to their credit, either abstain or vote no on the bill, despite the potential political consequences, which when you're going against organized labor, when you're going against the chair of appropriations, you know, you never know what kind of consequences there are going to be down the line in the future. So the one thing that I really took away from this defensive victory was that the power of the people and the voters does really remain supreme. So you can have, you know, many lobbyists, lots of campaign donations, but if you really have the people on your side, victory is possible, and it is possible to both pass good public policy and defeat bad public policy. So I'm keeping my eyes and ears to the ground because it's very possible something else comes out of 1139, some gut and amend to a bill later in session, or, you know, next year some other attempt will be, you know, up again to, you know, hurt the rooftop solar and distributed energy resources community. But right now, we're really happy that we can now turn our attention to focus more on the Public Utilities Commission's and NEM 3.0 proceeding now, and make sure that as we transition to a, you know, reduced version of net metering and look towards alternative rate-making policies for solar energy consumption, that it's done in a gradual manner so that consumers aren't feeling like they were bait and switched, or that they made their investments with certain assumptions and now would not be able to, you know, pay back their investment or afford solar. So that's one of the really crucial challenges ahead of us in these coming months, is to get a positive outcome in the regulatory process.
Well, Ali, we're almost out of time, and I missed a station break back there, but no matter. Do you have any last words for us about, what legislation might be coming down the pike?
That's a great question. One that I'm really excited about, to leave on a positive note, is SB 99, the Community Energy Resilience Act of 2021, being sponsored by Senator Dodd, who represents the Napa and Sonoma area, obviously had very devastating consequences to the wildfires, as well as numerous blackouts over the past couple of years. And this bill is looking to create a technical assistance program at the California Energy Commission that would give grants to local governments to develop community energy resilience plans and really look holistically at municipal facilities and their individual communities' needs, and work on strategies to help them become more resilient in the face of power outages. And so I do think that's one really positive one that passed out of the Senate with flying colors and is now in the Assembly, that I'll be watching carefully and, you know, working behind the scenes to do my best to make sure that one gets passed, because I think that's a great, great initiative and a good next step. We often hear that local governments have, you know, limited budgets, limited staff. This program will really help give local governments the capacity to build energy resilience in their communities and really serve their constituents' needs.
Well, thank you. My guest today has been Ali Detrio, who is the chief strategist of Reimagine Power in San Francisco. And Ali, I want to thank you for that lesson in lawmaking and sausages. That was extremely enlightening.
Thanks so much for having me, Ronnie. You asked great questions, and it was a pleasure to be on the show. And thanks to all of the listeners out there.
As a reminder, shows from the 5 to 6 p.m. Sunday slot are rebroadcast the following Tuesday mornings from 6 to 7 a.m. If you'd like to listen to previous shows, you can find them at ksqd.org/sustainabilitynow and Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Pocket Casts. Thanks for listening. And thanks to all the staff and volunteers who make K-Squid your community radio station, including Christine Barrington, who was engineer for this show. And so, until next every other Sunday, sustainability now.
But something got the matter, the machine, it would not go. So Dunderbeck, he crawled inside the reason for to know. His wife, she had a nightmare, and walking in her sleep, she gave the crank a heck of a yank, and Dunderbeck was meat. Oh, Dunderbeck, oh, Dunderbeck, how could you be so mean? I'm sorry you ever invented that wonderful machine. For dogs and cats and long-tailed rats will never more be seen. For they'll all be grounds to sausage meat in Dunderbeck's machine.